Our culture is in a crisis, and the solution to that crisis is the gospel message. St. John's Seminary, the seminary of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, offers an online MA in pastoral ministry degree for anyone interested in receiving formation for ministry. This program helps students improve their knowledge of the Catholic intellectual tradition and develop practical skills for ministry. A studio with professional video, audio, and lighting equipment allows our students to have an enjoyable technological experience, a necessity for any online learning environment.
Anyone who is working in and around the Roman Catholic Church in North America needs an education like this. There's no way you could get this kind of education anywhere than at a seminary.
Our online Master of Arts in Pastoral Ministry offers you the chance to continue your education in ministry and designed to provide you with the knowledge, spiritual formation, and practical skills that you need to serve the family of God in our parishes, schools, and other ministries.
By grounding yourself in the intellectual tradition of the Catholic Church, you will be able to go out into this culture and leaven it with the good news. Welcome to the podcast. My guest today is Anthony Grumbine, who is an architect and principal at Harrison Design, which is a national architectural firm that has six offices across the country. Anthony is an approved architect for the Archdiocese of Los Angeles and the Diocese of Orange County, and serves on a number of boards, including the City of Santa Barbara's Historic Landmarks Commission and the Santa Barbara Trust for Historic Preservation. His architecture projects range from new and remodeled churches to Catholic campus buildings to historic restoration and private residences. He approaches architecture with a strong respect for tradition and the pursuit of truth, beauty, and goodness in the built environment. First of all, Anthony, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Stuart.
So I'd like to have a conversation about Catholic architecture, sort of its purpose, the struggles it's been facing in recent years, the direction it's heading, and some questions about you personally and your interests in architecture.
Sure.
So why don't we start... Certainly, you know, beautiful architecture is not necessary to worship God. In the early church, for example, worship happened in house churches, which may or may not have been all that beautiful. But there's clearly an impulse in Christians that they want to worship in beautiful spaces. What would you say is the purpose of beautiful architecture? How does it spiritually uplift us?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So I think when you look at architecture in general and its role in telling us about reality, about life, about our culture and what we believe in and what we want in our highest aspirations. It's sort of within that framework of architecture as a cultural expression, and beauty plays a role in bringing beauty and truth play a role in telling us as humans what we see as important and why, and so. It can express realities to us, the truth to us. And so when it comes to Catholic theology and Catholic architecture, church architecture, and then institutional as well, and sort of down the line, it has the ability to, if done well, and we have examples throughout the centuries and millennia of incredible Catholic architecture and art that have been really these beautiful expressions of these Catholic cultures and Christian cultures. Those expressions are made real to us through architecture, through art, through music, through those different means. So while beauty is not essential as for certain utility reasons, beauty is in a very real way essential for human flourishing and human life. So in that.
Let's explore that theme of beauty a little bit more. And it's been gotten a lot more attention in the past few decades, thinking of people like Hans Urs von Balthasar. Of course, Bishop Robert Barron is constantly, to his credit, talking about when we evangelize, start with beauty rather than truth and goodness. Not that those are bad, but in this sort of postmodern mind, beauty is the place to begin. So let's just explore that a little bit. What is beauty? What are some of the basic principles of beautiful architecture in general? And what are some basic principles of beautiful architecture in parishes and other ecclesial structures?
I think one of the ways in which we can tackle the beauty question is, and without, and I think using the style wars that happened between like Gothic revival and neoclassical and different styles over time have been the discussion. It's very interesting to sort of look back through history of what every style and every culture and era did. And it was sort of one professor used to say this in my grad school at Notre Dame was, you know, everyone disagreed with everyone else about what was the most beautiful and why, and they tried to outdo each other. So, you know, the Gothic are like, oh, yeah, well, let's go taller and more stained glass, and the Romanesque is darker and, you know, more regular round arches, and we're soaring to the heavens, and it's extremely beautiful walking to, you know, Chartres. So, and then the Renaissance are like, no, it's about, you know, it's about humanism and proportion, and you know, then you have St. Peter's and this absolute grand beauty and balance and proportion and symmetry in these, and then you go into sort of and Baroque, and they're like, no, let's just go every marble, you know, all in every marble. It's so, you know, overwhelm the senses, and actually, the Baroque really was that kind of you know, part of the Counter Reformation. Was the arts and the overwhelming of the beauty of the senses as part of that call. And so you see this art that just is so exuberant and the architecture so exuberant. So every sort of you know, culture and time, and this goes pretty universally across the world, really, they disagreed with what was the most beautiful and why, but they were all striving for beauty. And that was a huge difference with you know, modernism. And the philosophy behind it was a nihilistic, there is no such thing as truth or truth, therefore everything's subjective, therefore there's no such thing as beauty, because beauty is in the eye of the beholder, it's not in the thing itself. So we stopped trying to make things beautiful, and it worked. You know. So now we're starting to get to this postmodern, and there's been a huge revival in, which I think is a very awesome and hopeful thing, and Notre Dame was a key part of it on the architecture side of things. And now there's Benedictine, there's Catholic U, even Yale, there's others that are having these classical revival programs. And we're going back to, not back to whatever was done before, but back to what our roots are, and then going forward from there. So it's that sort of, but now the goal is to struggle to make these even more beautiful things. And what can we do with that as our tool? So
I want to come back to the education part later. You mentioned some schools. As an educator, I'm really interested in that question. But sticking to your point about postmodern thought and the sort of the idea that all things are relative, including the beautiful, that I get, at least from their philosophical assumptions. What I haven't understood is how do you get from that to, because all beautiful things are relative, you know, subjective, but then the move went to, in architecture and art, we're not even going to try to pursue our own personal understanding of beauty. Like, it was just a rejection of beauty across the board, objective or subjective. Can you enlighten me as to how did they go from subjective to just, let's just reject beauty, period?
Yeah, I think it became, what was the object of art, right? So before, the object of art was the beauty, or architecture, is the building beautiful, both beautiful and useful and long-lasting things, right? So beauty was part of that, and it was the art of building, right? So the object of that art was beauty as a goal. Well, once you say it's subjective, and there is no, you're not arguing about, and you're not theorizing and going back and forth about what's more beautiful and why, all of a sudden you can't have that conversation because there's no longer an objective truth that you're actually pursuing.
Yeah.
So then what do you want to pursue? Well, what does the artist feel is great or important or political or needs to be said or you know, their own personal problems with their, you know, dad or whatever.
You know what I mean? Oh, that plays into it. It definitely plays into it.
It just became a whatever, and the reality is, why should I look at art or you know, things that are supposed to be beautiful and raising me up, and instead it's just dealing with someone else's baggage. And how is that really great art, or how is that holding us to a level that we're really pursuing the higher things? So, and there is sort of that built-in truth aspect to it as well. So, and there's also the other aspect of beauty is there are certain measurable beautiful things in proportion, in harmonies, in all these things that actually are measurable and definable and pleasing to the eye naturally. And so there is a certain objectiveness in that study as well that is fruitful for everything from painting to architecture. Mm-hmm. So there's also the counter to it is there are actually objective things, and that's how we can appreciate those different arts, and they can move us in those ways, and why most modern art and architecture has a harder time moving the soul of the average person, of the majority of the people that see it.
I mentioned to you before we started recording that when I was getting my PhD, I wrote a paper exploring the theological underpinnings of Gothic architecture. And when I finished the paper, I wasn't particularly pleased with the paper, or as much as I could tell, the literature itself, that there didn't seem to be a much of an engagement between theologians, historians, and architects about how the truths of our faith can and are articulated through architecture, especially in those time periods prior to now when most people couldn't read.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I know you're not a theologian, but I'm wondering if you have thoughts about how church architecture speaks the truths of the faith, especially to people who can't read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's great. Interestingly, the part of this conversation has happened over the last 1,000 years. This was actually a Gothic conversation, and Anton Logier was, no, it wasn't, it was, anyways, one of the Gothic monks was arguing with another one and was pointing out that if you're getting distracted in Mass, it's mm-hmm. better to be distracted and be elevated by the things that you're distracted
right.
by, or you know, if you can't totally focus and, you know, go into prayer in that way, there's these other things that are sort of lesser ways of praying, but you're still seeing the things that are telling you about heaven and hell and the angels and the telling you the stories as well, pictorially, as well as, you know, through inscriptions or if you read or those things. So the architecture that spoke and has always in all various ways spoke to us, it was real and a part of it, both for the literate and illiterate. And so I think it's sort of playing into that, that used to be the regular discussion. There were lots of books in the early 1900s when those conversations were still being had about the meaning behind things, everything from colors to materials, and imbuing, you know, iconographical meanings within buildings. And not just churches, but churches were the sort of the exemplar because they're the built theology, they're the highest. So that has been part of the conversation, and that conversation just basically stopped, and we're now at a rebuilding time where mm. we're really, in the last 30, 40 years have been, and they've been making great progress, but there's all the sort of knowledge was lost, the arts were lost, the craftsmanship was lost, the discussion was lost, mm. so there's not a lot of books, so there's all those things have been lost, and now they're starting to build back. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very exciting time in that way. But, you know, another 20, 30 years, there's probably going to be some of those books back in discussion. And there are those discussions happening now. Within a very minority of these institutions.
Mm. Well, I'm glad to hear you're saying that there's a sort of a renaissance of these conversations. If you could sort of wave a magic wand, how would you like to have theologians, historians, and architects come together and have those conversations? What are they talking about? I'm guessing a barrier is, you know, in higher education in the past 150, 200 years, based on sort of German university principles, you have this hyper-specialization such that I, as a theologian, I really can't mm-hmm. speak to you. And I'm guessing you, as an architect, have a hard time speaking to me because we don't have much of a shared, other than, you know, basic gospel principles, a shared language.
Mm-hmm.
So what would those conversations look like between those groups? How can we have productive mm-hmm. conversations?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the first step is finding the common ground but where the intersections happen between the two.
Mm.
And then starting to look at it from both of those angles. So in the example of architecture and theologian, the church would be the first and foremost place, you know, discussing with a theologian about, you know, city hall and what it should look like as an architecture thing wouldn't be as fruitful or very fruitful, but discussing with a politician and with, you know, those people that are, you know, strongly involved and understand all the philosophy and underpinnings of that that institution or that thing, I think would be a great place of starting and looking at those intersections from the architecture point of view, how the architecture may or may not embody the ideas that they are most strong in. And so one of the things that oftentimes the best projects happen when there's, for on the church side of things, where there's a super smart and engaged priest who has a lot of different of the theology, both ideas, and is learned about it and can have the discussion. And there's one particular in Long Beach, Father Peter Irving, that we've had the privilege of working with for over like 12 years now. And he picked up very quickly architectural language and the rules and the principles and proportions and all those and details. And the funny thing is that I got trained very quickly, and within a couple years, and that's quick, he's noticing things that are being executed wrong, whether it's a little molding or something else. He's saying, something's wrong with this. Take a picture. He takes a picture. He sends it to me. He says, I know there's something wrong. I don't know what it is. I don't know what the rule is. It's breaking, but now I know it's something wrong. So, right. And it's in that intersection when you talk about what, how important and hierarchies within a building of spaces and of finishes of the floor, of the ceiling, of all the pieces and parts, and what is that space, what is its purpose as it relates to the whole, and how, and that is a question more for the use and the philosophy and theology of the space, as opposed to what the architectural basic principle is. Architecture is at service of those things. So it's in those dialogues, I think, that are very, very fruitful. As a larger whole, the Renaissance as a movement, kind of as a holistic understanding of culture, I think that is for sure part of the important conversation that needs to be had. And part, I guess the simple answer is by getting together in whatever way possible, mm-hmm. and having those common, having things that overlap, and being able to talk about those things in a hyper-specialized world. And then to create within that framework, which is really an amazing experience to be able to create something new or beautiful or magnify something with a group of people that all have their different strengths to add to to the whole, to the greater whole.
Some architects want to sort of, we were sort of hinting at this earlier, kind of throw off all convention and blaze new architectural paths. Others want to just sort of copy past styles without innovation whatsoever. How do you think about how church architecture should be conceived in order to spiritually nourish the people of God, specifically in the 21st century?
Yeah. I'll do a Tolkien reference.
Great. I can handle that. I can handle that.
Okay. So architecture is like language, right? So it has a grammar, it has, a syntax, it has structure, it has all these things. It has words, and it has the composition of those. So when you go to write a beautiful poem, you're working in a language, you're working within a structure, and you're creating something beautiful, and that's how it comes together. Architecture is very similar, whether the language is Gothic Revival in a certain location with certain materials, with certain craftsmanship, with all those, with the very specific of its locale. And within working within, so the tools that you have, and then the language that it is, working within that and creating something beautiful. People worry, and this is a very modern artist's worry, they worry about not doing something new. And this ties to that principle of seeking for beauty. Up until modernism, it wasn't about doing something new, it was about doing something amazing, and beautiful, and great. Mm-hmm. Who cares if it's new or not? Because it will end up being new in lots of different ways. So the best thing to do is study the greatest things that you can of those artisans, or those architects, or those whatever, the musicians. Study all the greats in the most extreme way possible, and sort of immerse yourself and absorb it. And then when it comes to your design solution that you're going to come with, you have all these tools and all this knowledge, and then you can come to the design question, and then you can come up with a great, beautiful solution. That might be a building, that might be a doorway, it might be whatever the solution is. It's from the smallest thing, like a paneling and doorknob, to a whole massive building. It's you come with what you've kind of absorbed and learned, and that's always been the way it was. It was through the ages. And so Michelangelo, who everyone's like, yeah, greatest architect, one of the greatest architects ever, He was totally immersed in all and had these amazing teachers and worked with all these amazing crafts, you know, people and masters of their arts. And he learned from them and he played with it and he was inventive, but he was inventive within a system. And so to my Tolkien reference, it's sort of like, you know, in what architects nowadays try to do or have for the last 100 years is from the modern perspective is you can't do it. You have to do something new. It has to be your own. So you can't copy anything. So you have to first invent your own language.
Mm.
And then you have to write a poem in it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Tolkien did that. You know, there's very, very few that can.
Right.
Now, no one speaks Elvish, so they don't know if they're any good. So part of the advantage is you played by you made your own rules,
right,
and then you played by it. But as a bit of a joke, but really that's the mindset that we got to check ourselves with that because. And the irony of the whole thing is, it's still okay in the modern language world to quote 1920s modernism or 1950s modernism. All these other things, they're totally pulling from it in the way that classical Renaissance pulled from the Romans and their neoclassical pulled from the Renaissance and the, you know, insert anyone pulled from someone else. And so everyone still does it. It's just that their reference point, they just don't allow anything traditional because it's based on beauty.
Yeah.
So it and they're right in that because they are different philosophies.
I'm sure you've had many, many conversations about the state of church architecture in the West over the past few decades. And, you know, we don't need to rehash those.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't even really want to think about sort of the atrocities. But sort of looking forward in light of this sort of atrocities that architectural atrocities have happened, what would you like to see happen in the church architecture in the years moving forward?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of really great movement towards beauty within churches. I think the next biggest challenge, because, you know, 30, 40 years ago, the renovations were still flying, right? So the renovations of churches, tearing things out and re-swishing things around and not understanding the principles of what a church is, what a Catholic church is, and the liturgy, and how in which the architecture must be enhancing the liturgy and what that means and what that should be. All those things were still, but now there's been a great movement in beautifying the church and appropriately elevating it to what its function is, which is to reinforce liturgy. So that's all been good. I think our next big challenge is we're going, our heart's in the right place in general now with going towards beauty and magnifying the liturgy more and more. And so that's good. That's good. That's great. But now we got to get really good at it. And I think that part of the problem is we've lost all that knowledge of what good architecture is and why. And what I mean by that is very well studied, understanding the proportion rules, understanding the language of the architecture you're working in. Every molding has a name. It has a purpose. It has a history. It has a reason for being. So when you go to change it, it's fine to change it, but you got to know what you're doing. And if you don't, it ends up being sort of cartoony, Disneyland-ish. It gives traditional architecture a bad name because it's a sloppy version of that traditional architecture. So I think we just need now is the time to really, and it is happening, but be more diligent and more astute at our architecture and dial it up even more. Cause that's, my test in my mind is if these architects came back or to life or sent down from heaven or up, depending on the architect. Gaudi, he gets to come down from heaven.
Okay.
Others, I think they're coming up. But if they were to, if you had, you know, 50 architects from the past and ranged through time, and they stood and looked at our churches now, or any church now, take your example of church and put it in front of this panel of 50 classical or traditional architects of all different times and ages, if the vast majority of them would think that your architecture is garbage and have the reasons for it, and they would all agree, then I think we're not there yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's when they would get impressed or surprised or like or see something, they could see something new or it's just done really well, and that they would the vast majority would agree with it. So that kind of test is basically a test of of knowledge of a culture and applying it to that building. So when our buildings start making that kind of a level of kind of seriousness and awesomeness, and just your beauty and move the, and then I think those buildings will be the ones that also move people nowadays the most as mm-hmm. well. They're the ones that actually are so perfectly designed and beautiful and harmonious and balanced, and all the pieces come together perfectly. They really move the soul, and all the subtle rules that the people don't know about, the architects would, and they would know why that it works this way and why it's so beautiful and is so well done. So it's kind of a weird, odd test, but I think that's when we know that we really are now at that higher level. Mm-hmm. When we compare ourselves to the greats of, and we can say we're at least on par or we're getting there as a culture. So we've got a long ways to go still. But I think some of those buildings that are being done now are hitting that mark. Mm. There are some really beautiful, stunning things. Thomas Aquinas College nearby us, this church, obviously, but this is the chapel here, but it's obviously 100 years old. But Thomas Aquinas College is one of the most beautiful church buildings built since World War II.
Yeah.
And it is, and it's exquisitely done to, you know, every detail. So I think that's our bar. If we can get up there, I think that the architecture will be serving its purpose in nowadays. And I think we can, but mm-hmm. it takes a lot. It takes a lot of different hands to be able to do that. It takes a lot of craftsmanship and that too.
You mentioned earlier some schools that are sort of making a push to change how architects are trained. If you were, let's say, a dean of an architecture school, how are church architects formed to be church architects? And if you could change the educational processes for church architects to make it better, what would you do? How would you make? What do they need to be trained in, or how do they need to be thinking?
So it's interesting. I think first they need to be one key aspect is they need to be a really good architect, right? So they need to understand how the language works and how it goes together. And then they need to be trained and understand the theology and what is being expressed. Because mm-hmm. the artisan or the craftsmanship or whatever, those on that one side of things, doing something beautifully and well. And this is interesting because part of the question in my mind is as well, like, can someone who's not strongly Catholic and understands the theology, can they do a great church?
Mm-hmm.
And I think they could do a really good church, but the great churches need to also be, from the artist side of things, they're not just reproducing something that was good, but they're actually incorporating everything from what that culture and that parish or that moment is and responding to it in a very particular way that is magnifying the liturgy at that time and place and in a full effect. So one example is iconography, mm-hmm. right? So interweaving everything from inscriptions in moldings that tell things about where you're entering or what's happening to sequences of, artwork and panels that tell a story. That kind of incorporation of the architecture and art and thoughtfulness, the more you have in terms of your sort of theological tool belt, the better you can incorporate in your artistic, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there should be some training for architects who want to do church projects, because the best churches will come from, they'll be able to do slightly better if they really understand the theology, and that's where we can get to that A+ level, I think. And without it, I don't think you're going to get to that A+ level. I think you're not going to understand as well what you're actually designing, mm-hmm. and so you're not going to seize the opportunities that you might have, that you will have. The opportunities will be there, but you won't even recognize it if you don't understand the theology well,
because mm-hmm.
then you're not you don't know what you're magnifying, so you're just trying to do a nice building, So I think I would say that would be part of it, would be courses in sacred architecture. At Notre Dame, there was one of my mentors, Duncan Stroik, who did the chapel at TAC. He still teaches a course in sacred architecture, and that was a really great grounding. And even coming from someone who grew up Catholic, and it was a fantastic grounding. And it was sort of the beginning of of my real understanding of the liturgy from the context of from the architectural context, and then all these different ways in which you can magnify the liturgy based on that.
A couple questions about you, if I may.
Sure.
Can you give an example of how you've been sort of spiritually uplifted in your prayer life by architecture?
So I think a lot of it, some of the best examples were actually studying in Rome, and really for grad school, really experiencing just the amazing, overpowering beauty, and the sort of the how all the everything can come together, and just overwhelm you and make you really and made me feel like the extreme order and presence of God and the holiness of the place and the sacredness of it in a way that that really, you know, affected me and affected the joy of prayer and wanting to be able to do that for others in you know, be able to apply that, because that was you know, something that was just so you know, sort of overwhelming. Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris was another one. It was just, you know, just amazing and overwhelming how you know, how you were in, you know, in God's kingdom, you know, and you're at a scale that was the heavens. And so it was sort of the movement of the soul in a very strong way, that just brings such joy. So I think that has been sort of the ways in which I've been moved in prayer, in architecture, that and a few projects that I've been working on over time, as well, just you know, sitting and praying, sketching and whatever, and just kind of like sort of being swallowed up by both the things working and being beautiful and magnifying what's happening there and being able to be a part of it. So that's also been a way in which just work has been, really, really awesome, and has given me that appreciation of what it can and should be doing for our souls when we go there. And it's also a little taste of heaven, and to see it even in the poorest parishes, I mean, it's for everyone, which is really an awesome thing.
Right.
And when it's done well, it's like a great gift to humanity, really. So,
what's your favorite architectural style and why?
especially a Southern California architect, especially my professional career, if you had asked, it's interesting. You probably asked me that at different times in my life. I'll answer different things. I would have gone more Roman and Baroque, actually, post grad school. But I've really grown to appreciate this regional style of Southern California, and especially the 1920s, where it really came to its sort of this beautiful combination of mission and our mission heritage, and then also the integration of Mediterranean, Italian, and Spanish in Southern California. And so I've really grown to love it a lot. And so I think probably right now that's kind of my favorite style. I also like Gothic, so it's a tough one, and it's sort of like picking your favorite child. You know, I have an order. They're all in order, but no, just kidding. I love you all, kids, if you ever listen to this.
Well, I could sit here for hours and speak to you about this. So many more questions, so many more things to talk about, but I want to respect your time. So let me finish up with one last question. I always like to end on a note of hope. We are a people of hope, specifically hope in the resurrection. When you think about the architectural issues that we were hinting at, but we didn't want to talk about explicitly the previous decades, but we think about those schools that you had mentioned and the way that the young people are being formed. You talk about the renaissance of the conversations about among theologians and architects. What gives you hope for the future of church architecture?
Yeah, so I think church architecture, 20, 30 years ago, I would have had a more bleak outlook on it.
Yeah.
I think there has been some really great, awesome movement and progress with it. I also think it's a pivotal part of forming culture, and it's part of our greater, I think, Catholic calling in terms of that. So I am very hopeful about where things are going. I think that Benedictine College maybe 5 years ago plus started a classical. It was an offshoot from Notre Dame, and actually an offshoot from the original founder of Notre Dame, Thomas Gordon Smith, the original founder of the classical program, and his right hand went out and started Benedictine's Classical Architecture School, and others, Catholic U as well. So I see in the institutions more and more success within the traditional realm, and getting bigger and real projects that are really exciting and are moving people. So I see that as really, really fantastic, and I think I think there's a lot to be positive about. I do think that the important thing that as people have takeaways in all these things is that as we go forward, we need to hold, especially as Catholics trying to express the highest form of truth, we need to do it in the highest level of the arts and in the highest way within those arts. So I think it's really important that any of those that out there that are part of a new church or a new project or things like that, make sure that the architects and the artists that you're working with really are trained in that way. And Notre Dame does a great job, and now Benedictine will be, and then the Catholic U has a half of its program is classical. So making sure that they're actually trained in that will be a great start to the things that we build lasting long and being super beautiful and actually passing a high level of tests. And now they're out there. So the great thing is every city has these architects now that are that have been trained in the classical realm. So it's now a thing that we can actually be doing. So it's very hopeful, I think, and we can. It's a great snowball that really is a super backdrop and a magnifier of what the truth that we're trying to say.
Good, that's wonderful. I'm glad to hear there's hope in that in that field. Well, Anthony, so much. Thank you so much for joining me. I really, really enjoyed this conversation.
Absolutely, Stuart. It's my pleasure.
Our culture is in a crisis, and the solution to that crisis is the gospel message. St. John's Seminary, the seminary of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, offers an online MA in pastoral ministry degree for anyone interested in receiving formation for ministry. This program helps students improve their knowledge of the Catholic intellectual tradition and develop practical skills for ministry. A studio with professional video, audio, and lighting equipment allows our students to have an enjoyable technological experience, a necessity for any online learning environment.
Anyone who is working in and around the Roman Catholic Church in North America needs an education like this. There's no way you could get this kind of education anywhere than at a seminary.
Our online Master of Arts in Pastoral Ministry offers you the chance to continue your education in ministry and designed to provide you with the knowledge, spiritual formation, and practical skills that you need to serve the family of God in our parishes, schools, and other ministries.
By grounding yourself in the intellectual tradition of the Catholic Church, you will be able to go out into this culture and leaven it with the good news.